accession number 94343.
Mr. Bill Collins, Reel 3. During this period of, as you went into 1914, did you see any likelihood of war with Germany, or...?
Frankly, no. But there was obviously trouble in Ireland at the time, and in July there was a full-scale mobilisation in Aldershot, and we went out to Farnham Common, and I was assigned to a field battery, and the buzz was that we were all being mobilised to ready to go to Ireland to fight Carson's army, which was part of the Irish, part of the British army, which was up in arms against the trouble over there, you see, and led by Sir Edward Carson. And we were all fully mobilised, but that blew over, and we returned to barracks and handed all our kit in again.
There's two things I'd like to ask you about that. Firstly, what did you think about this mission you might have been sent on? Would you and the rest of your troops have been willing to fight?
Oh, well, no question about that. We didn't. We knew very little about it. We knew. I hadn't studied it at all. All we knew was that wherever we, as regular soldiers, a regular soldier doesn't ask for reasons why. He just gets an order and goes. But it didn't happen in the case of those fellows over in Ireland, because they were a lot of them were Irishmen. You see, when we were English, we would have gone in any case without any question whatever.
And the second thing is, how did the mobilisation go as a procedure? Could you remember how it went?
Oh, yes, we drew our kit out of store. You know,
how did you know what to do?
Well, we knew what to do was because we had to do, as far as we were concerned, was to go and join a battery, you see, and take over the medical stores, which were always ready for mobilisation. And wait for patients, so to speak. Wait for casualties, you see. That's all we had to do.
So the procedure went smoothly?
Oh, it went very smoothly, yes. But we were only there a few days, and it blew over, and we all returned to barracks. But what had happened was, you see, a full-scale practice mobilisation had taken place, and when it actually happened on the 4th of August... everybody was ready, or they all knew exactly what to do.
So, how did you first hear about the approach? When did you first hear that war was coming, and you became aware that Germany was going to be the enemy? When did it get through to you?
Not until practically the day it was declared, the day before it was declared, about 2 days before. That's all. No, not
so
earlier.
So you didn't follow foreign affairs
no,
very closely?
No. Never followed it. No. Neither did the depot. I don't think they just even thought about it. It came as a bolt from the blue, I think, so far as we were concerned.
So how did you eventually find out that war was declared?
We found it when I was told to report to 7th Brigade Royal Horse Artillery, you see. In the barrack room, the part of the preparedness for war, a card was over your bed, hung up on the shelf over your bed. Mobilisation unit, 7th Brigade Royal Horse Artillery. So that when war broke out, you knew that you had to pack up and go straight down there.
That wasn't the one you'd had to go to in July, though, was it?
No. We had no notification of that. That was a political job, you see.
So you each individual soldier had above his bed this card?
Yes, where he was to go on outbreak of war.
So when you were told that war had broken out, how did you get there? Did they give you a warrant to go on the train?
No, I walked down the hill to 7th Brigade Royal Horse Artillery, reported to Sergeant Major Barnes, the regimental sergeant major, and said, I'm the reporting sir for Duke for war service.
They were also at Aldershot, obviously.
Well, at Aldershot, yeah. They were at Aldershot. I had the old batteries, you see.
What did you think of the outbreak of war?
Quite frankly, I didn't think at all about it. I had no thoughts, I had no knowledge or any reason why. I'd never read the papers very much.
Did you think it would last long, or did you...
Well, everyone said it would be over by Christmas, you see. But one or two wise heads, including Lord Kitchener, said it would last for 4 years. And they were right, you see. That's why he initiated that recruiting system. And that famous poster, your king and country need you.
So what was your reception when you got to the 7th Brigade?
Oh, very good, very good. Sergeant Major Barnes, Regimental Sergeant Major Barnes, looked me up and down, and I suppose he thought I looked smart, well turned out, and he asked me one or two questions, and which I answered, and he said, all right, and he turned to the sergeant who was with him and said, he says, see that this Private Collins gets put on the ration strength, you see. And the sergeant said, he's not on it now. He says, get some money from the canteen funds. He said, that's what they're for. So I was living on the canteen funds for the first few days. Very well, too.
How exactly did you fit into the unit? What was your position within the unit? Where were you in the chain of command of the RAMC or...?
Well, actually, the equipment of the 7th Brigade medically was Captain Roland Philip Lewis as medical officer and myself as his orderly, you see. And we had to look after the two batteries and an ammunition column. And also attached was a very small headquarters staff under Lieutenant Colonel... J.F. Noel Birch, and the adjutant was Captain Scarlett, and the colonel's aide-de-com was Lieutenant Frederick Pyle. Now, there are two famous names there, because Colonel Birch afterwards became chief of all the artillery in France under Sir Douglas Haig, and Lieutenant Pyle became chief of Lieutenant General, Chief of ACAC in Great Britain during the next war.
Right. So there was only two of you, really, to look after this unit.
That's all.
Which battery were you particularly connected with? Because I believe you were with I battery.
Well, after I was connected with I battery later on, but at the beginning, when we went... I must tell you what happened when we embarked to go to France. You see, we left Aldershot on the 15th of August, and in the morning, while all the troops were packing up and putting the finishing touches, the Royal Artillery Band played on the square, and one of the tunes I remember it played was the hit waltz of the year called Destiny. Now, if ever a tune reflected what was going to happen to those two batteries, it was that tune, because within 14 days, one of them had been blown to hell. That was L Battery. On the 1st of September, it was caught in the morning mist, and four of its guns were destroyed.
Now, these preparations, what preparations did you have to do in your position, your medical officer?
I had to make sure that the equipment was in the we had a Maltese cart, you see, drawn by two horses and a driver, riding postillion, and I had to make sure that the stretchers and the medical supplies were there, ready for use when needed to be used by the medical officer or by myself.
How many stretchers and what sort of supplies?
Well, we had two
cart?
Stretchers and a sort of a portmanteau of medical supplies, bandages and all sorts of things.
What sort of? Can you remember now what sort of supplies it actually be besides the bandages?
There was iodine, tincture of iodine. There were scissors. There was morphine tablets, quarter grain morphine tablets. Some spare field dressings. That was the general makeup, you see. Aspirins, a few general medicines, you see.
The iodine, would that be used as a disinfectant?
No, the iodine was used to paint on wounds. In the First World War, at the beginning, when a man was wounded, if the area wasn't too large, you painted the wound with iodine and then bandaged over the iodine.
What was the purpose of the iodine?
The iodine was as a counter irritant. You see, it stung. It drew blood. The purpose of all those things were to draw blood there to help the healing purpose, and to seal the wound from the air getting into it.
So you had that, the morphine. Now, the morphine, that would be to...
bad cases. Only bad cases. And it was used only by the medical officer.
Were there any precautions about morphine? Is that one of them being misused?
No, they were tablets. Quarter of a grain of morphine in tablets, and were only to be used by the medical officer. Because I had charge of them, I had to keep them, you see.
So the Maltese cart would have this basic medical portmanteau and two stretchers.
Yeah.
What sort of cart was it? Did it have any markings saying it was Red Cross?
No, it was an open cart. It was an open cart, you see. Open cart, and the stretchers, the stuff was inside. It was an open top flat cart, and the stretchers were just in and poking out at the end. And when it was, canvas covered the top, and I used to have to lay on the top of the canvas. I had no seats or anything, I had to lay on top of it.
So that was a bumpy ride.
A bumpy ride from Mons, yes.
Where would the medical officer would have a horse?
We'd have a horse, he used to ride with the headquarters staff.
So, now, I believe you had an injection for typhoid, or against typhoid.
Yes, in the barracks, before we left, while we were kitting up and getting ready, mobilising, we had injections against typhoid in the barracks, and I had one that knocked me up for 48 hours. But I was really glad I had it, because when we got to France, Captain Lewis told me, he says, the two great dangers here are the soil is full of tetanus, which is the lockjaw thing, you know, and the water's full of typhoid. So I was really glad. But there were a large proportion of men, quite a lot of men, who refused the typhoid injection, because it was not mandatory, you see. It was not mandatory, and they just refused it. And out in France, there were large parades were held by senior medical officers to try and get them to change their mind. But it was still not mandatory, even as late as March 1915. It was still optional.
Now, it made you ill, you say. How ill were you?
Oh, very bad. You got a high temperature. You got the fever. The injection gave you typhoid. It gave you typhoid. You know, they toss it with typhoid for 48 hours. At least I did. But after it was all over, of course, it was gone, you see.
So, did you get anything about tetanus? Was there any prevention method before you went?
No.
Weren't any anti-tetanus jabs?
No. At the beginning, there were no anti-tetanic jabs that I could see hear of. They came later on. They came later in the war.
So, now, once you'd prepared checked in what your Maltese cart and everything, what was the next stage? You say on the 15th...
That was on the Saturday. On the 15th of August, the Saturday, we all went down to Aldershot Railway Station and then trained for Southampton. And we got there in the evening, and all night we were loading up the two batteries and the ammunition column and the headquarters, and we were loading up on a ship called the SS Rowan Moore, Rowanmore, and we stole out of Southampton Water about 3 o'clock in the morning or 4 o'clock in the morning. No goodbyes on the quay. There was not a sound when we slipped out there. All this flag waving and goodbye and all that didn't exist. We just stole out and went down Southampton Water along the coast all day, slowly.
How did you feel about leaving it? It was the first time you'd left, I presume.
I've had no feelings about it. I knew that we were going to war, you see. I just wondered what it would be like, you see.
How did you cope with the guns and limbers and your cart? Were they put on the train as well in goods lorries? Or
They were put on the train with a run-up, you see, a runway. They were run up onto the open-sided railway trucks and run off again at Southampton. Quite an easy job. My cart went up last.
So, when you were in the Channel, were you aware of any risks from either German surface ships or German submarines at that time?
Well, we were not aware until we got off Folkestone, and then we made a sharp right turn, and on either side of us, as we went straight across to Boulogne, on either side there was a destroyer to keep the submarines away, on either side. And we went across in the afternoon, and we landed up at Boulogne about 6 o'clock or so, or 6 or 7 in the evening. And as the tide wasn't suitable, we dropped anchor and went in on the following... That was on the Sunday night, and went in on the following tide early on Monday morning and detrained there. It was the 17th. Detrained all the guns and everything on the 17th.
Now, well, did you get any sort of a reception in Boulogne?
Yeah, absolutely. All the French were out there. They gave us a huge greeting. And the... because the first word of French that the troops learned was allumette, matches. We had plenty of everything but matches. Plenty of cigarettes, plenty of tobacco, and no matches. And so obviously the French knew about this, and these kids had boxes of them. They were offering, selling them. They weren't giving them away, they were selling them. Allumettes, the old stinker, the long thing. You struck one and it nearly poisoned you.
Well, how come you didn't have any matches? Was it just that they weren't issued?
Just they weren't issued.
Now, did you have people on the streets cheering you?
Oh, yes. Plenty of people there to cheer us at Boulogne.
And where did you go?
We went... when we got there, the guns were taken off the ship. We went straight up the hill outside Boulogne to St. Martin's Camp. And I believe we were the first troops to occupy it. We were in tents, bell tents.
Were the tents there when you arrived?
The tents were there when we arrived. And I believe it marks the spot where Napoleon once stood and gazed across the Channel, wondering whether he could invade England. But anyway, we were the first troops there. And there, hundreds of thousands came afterwards.
Now... in this camp, did they have things like the cookhouse established, or was there a camp cookhouse, or was it provided by your own unit?
What cooking there was little done was done by our own unit.
How long did you stay at St. Martin's Camp?
Oh, not more than two days, and then we were off. We entrained. We got on the train in Boulogne and went up by train with the guns and everything, and we got off the train at a place called Valenciennes, which is close to Maubeuge. Valenciennes, where we got detrained, and I remember after we detrained, a very fine battalion of the 2nd Battalion of the Argyll and Sutherland Highlanders came past us as we halted on the side of the road. They marched past us. They were marching on the way to go up ahead, you know, get ahead of us. But that's where we disentrained in Valenciennes.
Now, you didn't stay there long?
No, we moved almost immediately up to into Belgium. You see, to the front. And we arrived, I remember on the Saturday, August the 22nd, it was, we were at a place called Harmonies. And I remember walking up into the square at Harmonies, where there was a detachment of the 4th Dragoon Guards who'd had an encounter with the Germans earlier in the morning. And in the square was a pile of German saddlery, and a couple of lances sticking out of a heap that the 4th Dragoon Guards had set fire to them. And that was the farthest point we reached. We went back from Harmonies later that day.
Did you ask the Dragoons about this action? Did this first sign of war, what emotions did it stir in you? Were you excited or interested?
No, I was interested, not excited, but very interested to see this saddlery smoking away there, because obviously the 4th Dragoon Guards had had a successful action, you see.
Did they tell you what had happened?
No, I never spoke to one, because I saw them in about 180 yards away. They were busy and I didn't bother to go and interrupt them. I just walked back to the headquarters.
What did you know what was happening in the war at all?
No, didn't know at all. I was there halting and moving as the column went.
No, you moved out of Harmonies the same day?
Yeah.
And where did you go then?
Well, we must have gone a trifle north, I think, went trifle northways, because the next thing I can remember is we halted on the brow of the hill and overlooking some coal pits, and Colonel Birch and his staff came up, and the battery was ordered to lower the trails of a couple of guns, or it may have been one, and get them set for action, you see. And he watched them do it, get set on an aiming point, was satisfied, told them to limber up, and they limbered up and went away, and that was I never saw them again, never saw him again. In the war, not the Colonel Birch, but of course I saw Lieutenant Pyle, his aide-de-camp. I saw him frequently during the retreat, every day.
So this position was, I think you said earlier, above Mons or near
Mons.
Oh yes,
it was slightly to the south of Mons. Then later that day we went into a wood, through a wood, and came to a drive through the wood, a clear space, driven through the obviously shooting, a good shooting wood, you see. And we got to this spot where the drive went right away, and Captain Scarlett looked down, it was about nearly 100 yards of clear vision, and it bent away. And then he called up two of the gunners. One of them was the Rough Rider, and he said, "Go down the bottom there and tell me what you can see." And they cantered away, and in a few minutes they came back and said, "There are a lot of men in grey coats down there." So of course that they were Germans, you see, great men in grey coats, and because they didn't get too close because of the recognition. And then he said, "Right about wheel." And we got out of that place as quickly as we could, because there's no place to be caught in a wood. You don't get caught in a wood. And when we came out of the wood, we ran into D Battery, who had also spotted the Germans there and were moving off to a better position. D Battery was with the 3rd Cavalry Brigade.
Now, around about this time, I think you had your first experience of artillery fire.
Yes, in that wood, to the entrance to that wood, I heard the first shell burst above my head. It was a shrapnel shell with a highish burst, white smoke, and the bullets came down like whistling like all the hobs of hell, as if a thousand whistles had been turned on, you know. And the bullets, of course, were round, but they had a little tick on them that made them whistle as they came through the air. That was my first shell.
You do an impression, I believe, of the sound.
Well, they came down like that was the noise the bullets made as they came down.
Well, how did you react to that? What did you think of?
Nothing at all. I looked around to see if anyone was hit. Couldn't see anyone hit, and we moved away.
Was it a frightening sound, or?
No, actually, no. Ignorance was bliss in that case. Ignorance was bliss.
So where did you go from there after you'd met D Battery?
Well, after we passed D Battery, we went out on the main road, and we started the retreat.
So you didn't actually. This was all you saw of the Battle of Mons.
That's all I saw of the Battle of Mons itself.
And the battery didn't, in fact, open fire in.
I don't know, because the battery wasn't with us. You see, the battery moved away from us and the old battery, and our brigade headquarters went to the ammunition column and stayed with them for the retreat, all the retreat. So I lost contact with the two batteries for the retreat.
Right. Well, could you take us through the first stage? As you started to retreat, did you hear anything of what had happened at Mons? Did you hear anything about the battle at all from anybody?
No. The first signs we got were that the odd straggler, you see, the odd infantry straggler, and didn't hear a lot of it until we got to a place called Caudry. Caudry, close to Lacato. It was on the Wednesday. And, of course, a big battle opened there, and in the morning we were going towards Caudry and towards Lacato, and on the right, on our right flank, down in the valley, we spotted the Uhlans, the Germans, setting fire to a farmhouse. And so Captain Uniac, who was commanding the ammunition column, ordered half a dozen gunners over there to lay in a ditch at the side of the road with their rifles on the ready in case they turned on us, you see. And when they didn't, and they hadn't spotted us or didn't want to spot us, he ordered them up again onto the wagons. We did a right about wheel and went backwards from the way we'd come, continued the retreat. But On the way, towards St. Quentin, you see, but on the way, looking over there, sitting on my top of my Maltese cart, I could see in the distance one of the sights that one could seldom see. I saw a cavalry action. I saw Germans and British cavalry fighting with swords, cut and thrust, about a three quarters of a mile away on the left-hand side as we were going on the... We were on a high road, and they were a bit lower. But I could see this action going on. I was sitting watching this action, and I thought, well, what an extraordinary thing. You know, we've got a clear run on this high road, but there they were, cutting and thrusting about three quarters of a mile away. And about midday, he stopped us. Captain Uniac stopped the column. It was only three wagons, stopped us, and we turned into a hollow, which was protected on three sides by a high bank, you see, and stopped. I think he had been asked to stop there, but because very soon, over the hillside, a trooper came cantering over, a trooper of the Royal Horse Guards. I think it was the Royal Horse Guards. And there was a regiment, made up of the Household Cavalry Regiments, you see. Each house of the Household Cavalry Regiments contributed a squadron and made up a combined regiment of the Household Cavalry. And one of them came cantering over with a note, which he handed to Captain Uniac, who looked at it and gave it to the sergeant. And in a minute they were ripping open boxes of ammunition. They'd run out of small arm ammunition, and they wanted ammunition. And very soon this trooper was festooned with slings. You know, they had ammunition in slings, 200 rounds in a sling, and a sling over it. He was festooned as much as his body would bear, and he got up on the horse, and they festooned, put more over his, as he sat on the horse, he had more of them festooned. He went away with a hell of a load of ammunition, and within a quarter of an hour of his going, a terrific musketry rifle fire broke out 100 yards in front of us, 200 yards in front of us, no more, which they obviously wanted the ammunition. They'd been attacked, you see, but they had plenty of it. But that was almost the picture of the man galloping for the ammunition actually came true there that day. And I was just standing by watching with my surgical haversack slung over my shoulder.